The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. He to whom the emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. Albert Einstein. This is Victoria Duda from Zenith Lifestyle, bringing you the Metaphysical Podcast, Episode 1, Science and Reality. I'm the kind of person who's always asked, what is the meaning of life? It came to me as a curse sometimes, and it kept me from enjoying life as it is. Even in kindergarten, I remember that I used to sit in the corner while other kids were playing around. And I had a friend to whom we looked each other in the eye and asked the question, how on earth did we get here? And where are we? And why are we here? And the entire world seemed to be an extremely big mystery, and it was up to us and only to us to find a solution to this riddle. And ever since, I started to study all sorts of things, and I started to study mysticism and some of the more advanced religions like Buddhism, shamanism, and also the indigenous cultures' beliefs in altered states of consciousness. And I was hoping to make progress like that. I was hoping that there is a little bit of an objective answer to questions what has always interested humanity. I wanted to find answers to questions whether there are realities other than our everyday physical reality. I wanted to know whether there was life after death. I wanted to know whether we just lived once or whether we have lived before and will live after. And I also wanted to know whether we are truly, like all the major religions teach us, more than just our physical bodies. At the same time, while I was really interested in these questions, I also had a natural type of skepticism. I was thinking of these problems, but at the same time I thought, is it really justifiable to ponder upon such questions, or is it wishful thinking? And I don't know, some of you might have read the Celestine Prophecies, and if you remember in the book, there is a passage that tells that a lot of us are a kind of synthesis of our mothers and fathers. So if I remember correctly, the Celestine Prophecy says that you come to this world and then you try to harmonize whatever you get from your mother, and you try to harmonize that with whatever you get from your father. And that really applies to me, because I have a mother who's quite religious, and I have a father who is a archetypal scientist who would never believe in anything else but the atoms and the molecules and the periodic system. And I was trapped for a long time in between the two, and there was a time when I thought, I have to give up the mysterious kind of thinking, because it can't be serious enough, it can't be taken serious enough. And I probably would have gone down more that road. But then I had an experience that at that time I didn't know much to make out of. But I learned later that it is an experience that would be coined an out-of-body experience. And the way I perceived it at that time was that I was sleeping in my bed. It was back in Vienna where we lived at that time. And suddenly I woke up, but I didn't wake up in my body. I woke up literally at the ceiling, looking down to myself and my husband at the time sleeping in a bed. And there was a kind of voiceless voice commenting on this experience, telling me that this is what people will call out-of-body experience, and you must have it so that you know what they are talking about. And a voiceless voice also told me that this is the same kind of state into which people are going after they die. So what you're experiencing now will feel the same than death. And this might sound maybe to some of you as a little bit of a spooky experience, and it probably would have frightened me if I hear about it. But at that time when it happened, it was not just not frightening, but it was absolutely interesting and groovy and engaging, adventurous. It was something that I really wanted to know more about, and I wanted to stay in that state, and I wanted to experience it. But it wasn't up to me. I felt a very strong pull that was pulling me back into my body. and the experience was over in maybe 5 minutes. But what happened afterwards, and that is very much like the same thing that people say who have out-of-body or near-death experiences, that it completely changes the way you look at reality. I mean, there might be some outsiders who never had these experiences, and they might say, oh, you hallucinated. But the answer that I can give to them is the same that all other people who experience such things would answer, namely that it wasn't a hallucination. I just know it wasn't. And if it was a hallucination, then so be it. But then everything else in my life is a hallucination because the experience was not at all different from what I experience as everyday reality. So your entire life you've heard a certain theory about how the world works. And you've been told that we live in an essentially physical universe that consists of material particles, and that you live in a body, and your thinking and your consciousness derives from your brain. But imagine that one day you find yourself on the ceiling looking down at your own body, and still you're conscious. In that moment, that old worldview just seems to pop away like a soap bubble in the air, and you're looking for something else. And maybe at the time I thought I was alone, but in the meantime I looked into the numbers, and it says that alone in the United States of America, there are not thousands, not 100,000s, but at the moment 13 million people who have reported a near-death experience that involves an out-of-body state. So you start thinking that there must be something behind this tremendous documentation of so many experiences. Yet at the moment it seems that only half of the world is taking these reports seriously. There are people who are into spiritual development, who are into mystical thinking, and they don't just deal with these kind of cases, but they take them very seriously. But the other half of the world, that I could call the scientific part, is not even looking at these cases. There is a big laugh and a big rejection to anything that is not fitting into the current physical worldview. So I was asking myself, is there a worldview? Can we explain the world in a way that is just as rational and logical as science is, but at the same time allows for intuition and allows to get ourselves out of our comfort zone and involve cases that are currently not explainable without rejecting them from the very beginning? So the question I essentially asked myself, why was science and mystical thinking so incompatible? In 1962, a philosopher of science with the name of Thomas Kuhn wrote a book entitled The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And that is a book that might contain the answer to my question. Because in this book, Thomas Kuhn asks, how is science really made? And we might think that science is based on a theory. We might think that science comes up with theories to explain the world and then is searching to prove this theory. Science might make some experiments or might some logical deductions and then comes up with data that either proves or disproves that theory. And we might think with our common sense that if science finds data that proves the theory, then it will keep the theory. And if science finds data that disproves the theory, then it will change it. That is the logical way, isn't it? But the answer, according to Thomas Kuhn, is no. That is not the way science is made. Science is made in a much more political and socio-political way than we might accept. He brings a lot of historical examples. He says that we can think back of Copernicus when he first came up with the theory that it is not the sun that revolves around the earth, but it is the earth that revolves around the sun. And at the time he said that, he was just laughed at. Another scientist of his time who later said the same thing, Giordano Bruno, was burned at the stake for the same theory. Another interesting, albeit less well-known example is Ignaz Semmelweis, who was a doctor in 19th century Hungary, And he was a doctor before bacteria were discovered. So he lived before Pasteur discovered how to disinfect. And at that time when he was working in one of Budapest's largest hospitals. And there was an incredibly great percentage of mothers dying after childbirth. Semmelweis Ignaz didn't know the reason for that at the time, but he started to be suspicious of something, that his medical students and the young doctors who were working in the surgery and in the morgue before they went into the maternity ward didn't wash their hands. It wasn't fashionable at the time for doctors to wash their hands because they didn't know about bacteria. Semmelweis Ignaz suspected that there is a connection. So he made it a rule in the hospital that everybody who went into the maternity ward had to wash their hands before, and the mortality rate dropped. So we would now think that after that he was a celebrated hero. But no, he started to write articles on this and wanted to spread the practice into other hospitals of Europe. But he had a hard time publishing this. Then he had a hard time to prove anything. And therefore, he was not just disregarded, but laughed at. And there was a huge story of intrigue going on. As a result of that, he actually ended up in a mental institution where he died. And Thomas Kuhn says that this is not the exception. This is how actually science is evolving. So there is a scientific theory at any given time that is ruling. And he calls that the ruling paradigm. And he says that a ruling paradigm works for as long as it serves the majority of the population and the majority of the scientific community. The paradigm at any given time starts to get into trouble, so to speak, when there are a lot of anomalies coming up, cases that don't fit into that theory, a lot of data that would disprove it. But that still doesn't turn science around. What happens then that some of the leading scientists will come and say that this old paradigm is wrong, and they will come up with a revolutionary new idea. Like, for example, the world is revolving around the sun. And then the normal next step that happens is that these people who are coming up with a revolutionary new science, they will laugh at. They will be laughed at, or even worse, they will lose their jobs or in some extreme cases their lives. And only if a certain number of new evolutionary scientists are going to give their names to the new paradigm, and only after there is a so-called scientific revolution, then will the paradigm change into something new. The reason why this is interesting for us is because today there is a similar paradigm shift occurring in science. And when we shift a paradigm, the assumption change. I've mentioned at the beginning of this talk that I was growing up, and we all were growing up with a worldview where the entire world is assumed to be physical and is assumed to be based on matter. But from a scientific theory point of view, it is an important thing to remember that that is not a fact, that there is no scientist in this world who can prove that the world is based on matter, because matter itself is the stuff that science works with. So it can't be proven unless it is assumed. So my question now is, what if we turn the assumption and we say that we assume the world is based not on matter, but on consciousness itself? And please know that that again is an assumption. Neither I nor anyone else in the world will be able to prove that the world is based on consciousness. But my question is only, what can happen if we start thinking like that? If we keep still our rational mind, if we still keep our logic, but we will work with the scientific assumption that the world is indeed based on consciousness. And you might think now that if I'm the only person who's suggesting that, then not much will change in the world thinking. But interestingly, I'm not the only one. So already there are a number of leading scientists who are suggesting a paradigm based of consciousness. And for today, I brought a number of quotations that I would like to read out to you. And the common of all these quotations are that they come from scientists who received the Nobel Prize. The first one comes from Max Planck, who says, "I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness." Erwin Schrödinger says, "Consciousness cannot be accounted for in physical terms. For consciousness is absolutely fundamental. It cannot be accounted for in terms of anything else." Sergio Naclise even says, "Promissory materialism is simply a superstition held by dogmatic materialists." And finally, a quote from Niels Bohr, who says, "All of us know that there is such a thing as consciousness simply because we have it ourselves. Hence, consciousness must be a part of nature, or more generally, of reality, which means that quite apart from the laws of physics and chemistry, as laid down in quantum theory, we must also consider laws of quite a different kind." We have started a metaphysical podcast to invite you to explore a world with us that is based on consciousness. And we will ask the question, what is possible in a reality that is looked upon from such a different angle? What kind of things are there to explore, and what are the things that we can involve in our reality that perhaps were only on the periphery of your consciousness so far? We have an explorers forum on the website, and we invite you to join in today, asking the question, what do you think about those Nobel Prize physicist statements? Is there any point to that? Also, we will come back in the time of the next full moon, and we will begin our explorations with asking ourselves, if we look at the world from a consciousness-based point of view, what is it that we will notice first? What will be the greatest difference between the world as you look at it now and between a world you look at it from a consciousness point of view? Is it really, really going to be that different? Tune in and have you back at next full moon.